Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the program, we will bring you several stories we produced in 2019, including the reason why many sought to leave Wyoming following the announcement of bankruptcies in the coal industry.
I want that 401k, I want that pension, I want whatever comes with it. I feel like my family deserves that.
We will also take you to a lab where they look into wildlife deaths.
We have a lot of evidence that we keep here, so we have a lot of refrigerator space.
In 2019, UW unveiled its much-anticipated College of Engineering.
I think it puts us on par with the kinds of facilities that you would see at places like Stanford or MIT.
And stories about police shootings, mental health, and a controversy surrounding rock climbing. Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The top issue facing Wyoming in 2019 was the bankruptcies and struggles with the coal industry. When Black Jewel filed for bankruptcy, the move put more than 1,500 miners out of a job in Wyoming and across Appalachia. Many struggled to find work, especially a job that paid anywhere near what they were making. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim talked to some miners in September.
Quit.
Darlene Ray calms down her three dogs outside Gillette. Until 2 months ago, Ray worked in Black Jewel's warehouse, writing invoices, receiving freight. But since the coal company's abrupt bankruptcy, she's been stuck looking for work.
Every day, you keep waiting and wondering if somebody's going to call you, you know, and there's nothing.
Ray slaps down a sheet of paper listing all the places she's applied for jobs.
Peabody Energy, Cloud Peak, Campbell County Hospital, Walmart, Pegasus.
Next to many is the word rejection. Ray has a medically retired husband and a mortgage. Worst comes to worst, she'll have to sell the house and move. A tough option with grandkids nearby. She's struggling despite what she's hearing, that the job market in Gillette is strong. The local workforce center says companies are underemployed, unlike the downturn in 2015 and 2016. Even Black Jewel had openings until its bankruptcy July 1st. That day, when the company went under, it furloughed about 600 employees. 2 months later, only a quarter of those workers are back to work, plus a small skeleton crew, according to local management. With a strong job market, Ray has an idea why people like herself are struggling to find work. It's about job skills.
If you know how to drive a haul truck, can run a shovel, you know, an electrician, a mechanic, a welder. Yeah, the mines are picking you up left and right.
Rick Mansheim with the Gillette Workforce Center agrees. Mines are looking for skilled positions. But he says that's not the only reason so many locals aren't back to work. Most of those reasons don't have to do with the job market itself.
I think most of them are just waiting to see what happens.
In other words, hoping to get their old job back. At the start of Black Jewel's bankruptcy, warehouse worker Melissa Peterson-Warden fell into that category. We're talking in her office, as she calls it, a restaurant in downtown Gillette.
The one thing I've always heard is a mine will never close. They will never close a mine. And in one day, they close two.
But still, she was sure Eagle Butte and Bel Air would reopen and wanted to wait.
I wanted to be a part of that group that brought the mines back and came up from this unheard of thing that we had just gone through.
Being a part of that group meant she would get her old job back and restore these historic mines. Her plan, her hope, affected her job search.
I didn't even make it into the door of the job fair because my heart wasn't in it.
But now, after over 2 months of the mines staying closed, Peterson Warden's attitude has shifted. In fact, she would no longer work at Black Jewel, especially after hearing the potential buyers Contura do not plan to keep the mines open long term. But she still wants to get back in her field. That's where her focus is.
For me to accept a job that's either not in my field or not at the pay rate I want, that would be a temporary job to me. You know, I still want to be in my field. I still want to be associated with coal mining. There's definitely a standard of living that I would like to maintain.
Gillette Workforce Center's Mansheim says that's another common reason many are still out of work. The urge to continue that specific lifestyle of a miner, with good pay and long hours. However, Mansheim says those jobs are harder to come by. So former Black Jewel workers have moved elsewhere. South Carolina, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, all to find better, higher paying jobs.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Hey, man.
Dan Zarecki is moving to Montana for that reason.
I have had the option, several options, to take a big pay cut and work here in town. I want that 401k, I want that pension, I want whatever comes with it. I feel like my family deserves that.
Zarecki has a family and a baby due in October. His family wants him to stay in town. He'd prefer it too. But he says it's a dog-eat-dog world. You have to make sacrifices to get what you want.
It's only 2.5 hours away. I'll be able to come here on my days off. And it's worth it.
Workforce Center's Manchime says the job-seeking traffic has slowed down since the bankruptcy. But a new wave is coming in. People who've waited for Black Jewel to reopen are now ready to move on. He says a furloughed worker came in today and was ready to finally start a job search. It's been over 2 months now, and technically, Black Jewel has still not laid anyone off. But in Gillette, it sure feels that way. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Another major story was the police shooting of 58-year-old Anderson Antelope in Riverton. It was the second law enforcement shooting of a Wyoming man in less than a year. While the law enforcement community ruled the shooting justified, as Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reported this fall, the incident drew new attention to long simmering racial tensions in the reservation border town.
Dozens are marching down a busy street in Riverton, wearing red, holding signs, and chanting, "Justice for Andy." Anderson Antelope's nephew, Dean Wallowing Bull, says this march is a way to remind Riverton that the family is still waiting for answers about what happened to him.
We haven't had no word from any of the authorities. You know, they still haven't released the name of the officer involved in the shooting.
What authorities have shared is an allegation that Antelope attacked an officer who had been trying to arrest him with a knife. Antelope's family say he was a chronic alcoholic and was physically disabled and mentally unhealthy as a result. When police approached him, they were likely responding to a call about public drunkenness. Eyewitness accounts suggest that no one was in danger when officers first approached Antelope, that things began to escalate when an officer tried to physically move him from the sidewalk in front of the Walmart. This story is all too familiar to the family of another man who was killed by police, Zachary Bareheels.
How does one end up dead because they're considered a public nuisance by a business?
That's Adrienne Chelopaw, Bareheels' sister. She says that her brother, who was Kiowa and Lakota, was experiencing a mental health crisis when Omaha police detained him outside of a convenience store. He died after officers punched him in the head repeatedly and fired a taser at him 12 times. 3 years after her brother's killing, Chelopaw says the effects are still rippling through his tribal communities. She says it troubles her as her children grow up, looking less like Native boys and more like Native men.
I have a pretty severe case of PTSD right now because of this fear of the police. But at what point does the criminal justice system take responsibility for the breakdown in the trust in communities?
According to data from the Centers for Disease Control, Native people are killed by police at a higher rate than any other racial or ethnic group. Nationwide, people with mental illnesses are also more likely to experience violence of all kinds, including from police officers. But Antelope's family members believe the circumstances that led to his death are unique to Riverton. His niece, Autumn Wallowing Bull, says that her uncle was what some in the city might derogatorily call a park ranger. That's local slang for a homeless Native person who hangs out in the city park. Wallowing Bull wonders if that label might have led others to view her uncle as a nuisance or disposable.
I don't know if this cop just got frustrated with him, finally had enough of him, pulled his gun and just decided to end him when he could have just tased him or maced him.
Growing up on the Wind River Reservation, Wallowing Bull says she had her own bad experiences with Riverton police. Now, when she visits this reservation border town, she says she notices a difference in the way she's treated. Strangers stare at her, she gets followed around stores. She says she moved away because she doesn't want her children to experience that.
When we do come back here, I always have to tell them, hey, you guys gotta watch out. You know, watch out what you're saying, watch out how you look at certain people, keep your eyes to yourself. And they can feel it when we come back here. They can feel that animosity, that something's different.
The Riverton Police Department didn't want to talk to me for this story. They're still waiting for the State Department of Criminal Investigation to release a report. But Riverton Mayor Richard Gard spoke on their behalf.
Our police department is just that. It's a police department. And when laws are broken, they come and take care of those broken laws.
In other words, according to Gard, they're not there to provide mental health or addiction counseling.
I have total confidence in all of the officers. So I don't think there's a racial slant to this. I think there's people that would like to try to make it a racial slant, but I don't see that. And all the choices that were made by Mr. Antelope.
Mayor Gard says he knows that even though he doesn't believe Riverton police carry any racial bias, some of his constituents feel differently, and that has real consequences. I told him some Native people in Riverton don't ever call the police because they're afraid of what might happen to them or someone they love.
We want everybody to feel safe. We want them to call our police department. And so if I said, no, I don't care about what people's feelings are and their safety level, that would be totally incorrect. I do. The police do. So if you feel like you're targeted or there's a problem, you really should come in and explain to us why you do. And maybe you have a case.
While they wait to learn more about Anderson Antelope's last moments, his family members say they hope people will start to take racial divisions in Riverton seriously and work to break them down. Antelope's nephew, Dean Wallowing Bull, says that starts with the people who are labeled park rangers.
This needs to be addressed. You know, our street people up here in town, they're not safe. You know, and if anybody's on the streets and things happen to them, you know, who do they report that to? Because the city of Riverton police are not going to listen to them.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
When we come back, we revisit the fact that Wyoming still has problems dealing with those who have serious mental illness, and a look into the government-led coyote killing program. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. At the end of February, a major inpatient psychological unit in Wyoming closed its doors. The Pine Ridge Inpatient Behavioral Health Unit in Lander had shut down due to federal regulations. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudalska reported that a number of people with serious mental illness in northwest Wyoming had nowhere to go.
Chris Sturgeon lives in Lander. She suffers from major depression and multiple personality disorder. The day I meet her, she's not doing so well.
I'm in one of my major depressions right now.
Because of the recent closure of the Pine Ridge Behavioral Health Facility, she can't get the critical care that she needs.
I mean, thank God I am not suicidal and I don't have to worry about that. But I also know that I can become suicidal very rapidly.
For Sturgeon, the 8 to 13 bed unit with psychiatric staff to help the mentally ill was a safety net. She knew she could be helped within hours, but now the closest inpatient psych unit is 2.5 hours away at the Wyoming Behavioral Institute, or WBI, in Casper.
The last thing I heard was WBI is full, so it's not an option anyway.
So why did Pine Ridge close? A press release from the parent company, Sagewest Healthcare, said one of the main reasons for the closure was federal regulations to increase the ligature safety of these facilities. More specifically, the facilities need to be clear of anything that could be used to attach a cord, rope, or any other material for the purpose of hanging. These regulations are directed from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. Mark Covell is with the National Association for Behavioral Healthcare.
CMS decided that the regulations that were in place were not working the way they should, and they put in place a directive basically saying that all inpatient facilities needed to be ligature-free.
He says the problem with the CMS directive is there is no clear guidance for people who oversee these facilities who are known as surveyors.
And the changing interpretation from surveyor to surveyor has really wreaked havoc and has required some significant changes to the facility that in many cases did not increase patient safety.
What Koval is saying is that there's a lot of interpretation as to whether or not areas of the facility is safe or not. But regardless, some changes have to be made. Sage West declined to comment. But after speaking to a number of people close to the situation, it seems Sage West decided the cost of updating its facility did not benefit them in the long run. John Snook is with the Treatment Advocacy Center, which is a national organization that works to bring awareness on the trend of decreasing inpatient behavioral beds. He says inpatient beds are some of the hardest beds to keep.
And if you are a hospital trying to make money, or you're a rural hospital that is really struggling to make ends meet and keep the lights on, it's really difficult to justify having those beds.
Inpatient psych beds are expensive and don't really pay for themselves. Snook says these facilities are really important to the mentally ill.
And when they don't have the beds they need, they just end up in the systems that can't say no, or jails, or homeless shelters.
And this is something Scott Hayes is worried about. He's with Fremount Counseling, which is a mental health and substance abuse treatment center in Lander.
And so I do worry about it. I mean, ideally, you have somebody who needs that level of inpatient care, and they need it because their outpatient counseling is not going to cut the mustard.
He says Pine Ridge closing takes a chunk of availability away, and people have to look elsewhere. But there are only 4 other inpatient behavioral units in all of Wyoming. They're located in Evanston, Laramie, Cheyenne, and Casper. And they're also feeling pressure from CMS, says Mark Ressler, who is the director of an inpatient crisis stabilization center in Warland.
The state hospital is closing down units at a time to put in, I guess, alarm systems or something in each room. But there's a loss of 14 beds on each unit until they get all that work done.
But even if the Wyoming State Hospital does the construction to keep up with CMS regulations, Mark Koval says there's a possibility that another surveyor will come in and decide something else needs to be updated or changed because there's no clear guidance from CMS over what's required.
The surveyors looking at the facilities differently than they did before without any new guidance is a moving target.
A CMS representative said some official guidance will be released soon. No one disagrees that ligature risk is important, but some say there's a limit. For now, individuals like Chris Sturgeon, who we heard from in the beginning, will have to find a way to travel at least 2 hours or longer to an inpatient psych bed where there may not even be a bed available. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
The federal government kills thousands of coyotes every year in an attempt to keep them from catching their prey. It's gone on so long that it's become an accepted practice by many. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards found out, not all wildlife biologists agree that the killing is effective.
In a canyon near Rock Springs, a helicopter descends. 2 coyotes are handed out, bound and blindfolded. University of Wyoming researchers place them on a mat. The animals stay calm and still. PhD student Katie Hugler oversees this study.
So we collect sex, age, weight, and a few body measurements just to get an idea of how big the coyote is, those sorts of things. But really what's most important to us is that GPS data.
And it's data on collars these coyotes will wear the rest of their lives. Around 30 coyotes are now collared, and boy, do they roam. Hugler is amazed at one young female who wandered all the way to Colorado.
It's like 110 miles as the crow flies. Turned around and came back like 3 days later. And they're moving fast, but they're also moving really far.
But Hugler says they're curious if all that roaming changes during the window when mule deer fawns are born. Mule deer numbers around the West are declining, down by 31% since 1991. And some people blame coyotes. UW Wildlife Professor Kevin Monteith says they're mapping coyote movement to see if the predators are targeting newborn fawns.
They're definitely seeking out those places, which for an opportunistic carnivore like that makes a lot of sense. These deer are given birth within a 2 to 3 week period. It's a prey item that's highly vulnerable, protein rich.
It stands to reason that maybe killing off some of the coyotes would allow more fawns to survive. But Monteith says that's not what the research necessarily shows.
perhaps of why predator control can be a really challenging thing to do sometimes, because you may do your best to implement a control program in one area and the next day you just have an exchange of animals that come right back in and fill that place.
In fact, some studies show that if you kill off a lot of coyotes to help their prey, the coyotes breed even more, making coyotes even more of a threat.
Oftentimes, coyote control programs have been implemented in some or many instances, it seems like the effects were negligible.
Yet these conclusions haven't affected the high number of coyotes killed by wildlife services. That's the little-known federal program run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that conducts such lethal control. In 2017, the agency killed over 5,600 coyotes in Wyoming, mostly to protect lambs. Nationally, they killed 68,000. But some wildlife groups are wondering why coyotes are shot, trapped, and poisoned when the science doesn't show it works.
So yes, this is something that we've been working on at a national scale, really trying to transform wildlife services.
Colette Adkins is with the Center for Biological Diversity, a wildlife group that's filed a lawsuit against wildlife services in Wyoming because they say the state's environmental assessments here are outdated.
An agency like in Wyoming, which is relying on science primarily from, you know, 70s, the 80s, maybe the early 90s, that just isn't okay. When it's a couple decades old, they need to take another look.
And a lot of new information has come out.
And in this last decade, we really have seen this growing body of literature that points to the effectiveness of non-lethal methods, for example, using guard dogs or fencing or frightening devices.
Those are methods to protect livestock. Rod Merrill is with Wildlife Services in Wyoming. He says noisemakers and dogs do work, and Wildlife Services uses them, but the effects aren't long-lasting. As far as new data that female coyotes breed more after they're killed back, he's not convinced.
I have read those studies, and from my personal experience in the field for 23 years, I don't agree with them. The number of pups that a female is going to have is specific to genetics.
What Merrill is saying is that he's seen that lethally controlling coyotes does still work best to protect prey, whether livestock or big game.
The one thing I have learned in my career is that for every study out there that proves a particular point, there's another study that refutes it.
But more and more court judges are convinced by the latest research. California, Arizona, and Idaho all are now required to change their plans to include more non-lethal approaches. In the canyon, both coyotes now sport GPS collars. Researcher Taylor Lashar teaches a classmate how they're released into the wild.
When I'm ready and you say you're ready to go, then you'll like take your hands back really fast and I'll kind of push them. They run really fast. Yeah. Like, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
The young male coyote springs away from their hands. He looks back for a half second, confused at his freedom, and then he's gone. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Coming up on the program, a look at how officers treat warrants. Also, a visit to a lab where they try to determine how an animal died. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Police officers are expected to uphold the law, but what the law requires is not always clear-cut. For example, how law enforcement agencies interpret legal documents like warrants varies all across the state, and what officers decide to do can have serious consequences. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson witnessed one of those situations.
I'm on a ride-along with Albany County Sheriff's Deputy Jeremy Houston. We're rolling down a dirt road on the north side of Laramie, headed towards a spot where kids go to smoke pot after school. And sure enough, there's a little Toyota sedan parked just off the road, full of puffy white smoke. Houston parks, calls in his location to the dispatcher, and jumps out to check out what's going on. leaving me and his police dog behind in the truck. He chats with the three kids in the car for a bit. When backup arrives, he asks them to exit the vehicle so he can search them and the car, and he comes back to give me an update.
So he had a pipe, and the green container was full of marijuana, and she had a pipe in the back.
The two with weed on them are 18 and 19. They'll get citations for possession of a controlled substance. The third kid had nothing on her, so no charge. But because she's only 15, Houston has to release her to a parent or guardian. And it's when her mom shows up that things get interesting.
Oh, Jesus. Mom's got a warrant.
In case you didn't catch that, Houston says, Mom's got a warrant. What happens next baffles me. I watch out the front windshield as Houston hands citations to the 18 and 19-year-old, and those two, who are probably high, get to drive away. While at the passenger window, I watch tears stream down the cheeks of the 15-year-old girl as her mom gets cuffed and loaded into the second deputy's vehicle for a ride to the county jail. Luckily, her older brother came along with her mom, so she has a ride home. As we drive away from the scene, Houston explains what just happened.
So mom went to jail on a failure to pay warrant for on a no insurance charge.
No insurance while driving?
Yeah.
Okay.
She owed a $455 fine for driving without insurance, so the court had a warrant out for her arrest. And in Albany County, Houston says there's no way around that.
A lot of jurisdictions, traffic warrants,
Henry 3 registration.
The officers that are on scene have discretion on whether or not they want to release them or arrest them, but not our jurisdiction. Just 1 second.
If he responds to a victim of a crime who has an outstanding warrant, Houston says he'd have to arrest that person too. Farron Babbitt is the executive director of the Albany County Safe Project. She works with survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence, and she's watched clients be arrested at her shelter.
My experience has been that many times people don't realize that they have a warrant because it was maybe something really minor or something that in all of her trauma and in all of her chaos, she didn't remember or know about, and then she was arrested.
She says officers are generally kind and compassionate, but it can still impact a survivor's willingness to work with the criminal justice system in the future.
And then perpetrators are not held accountable.
Albany County Undersheriff Josh DeBree says that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
They have a warrant that was issued by the courts. It's not our decision to do something or not do something with it. So, we're going to take care of it.
DeBree says jailing folks who already owe fines ends up costing the county money. But some say there's another way to handle warrants for those who don't pose a threat to public safety. Levi Dominguez is the patrol lieutenant for the Sheridan County Sheriff's Office. He says warrants do command arrest, but the state statute says otherwise.
It says a peace officer may arrest a person when the officer has a warrant commanding that person to be arrested.
Dominguez says the word may is what gives officers the authority to take in the whole picture when doing an arrest on a warrant. Like if an officer pulls a parent over with 3 or 4 kids in the car for a taillight violation and discovers an outstanding failure to pay warrant.
Something that isn't a threat to the community, I guess. So at that point, is it in the best interest of everybody to arrest that person, or is it saying, hey, you have a failure to pay warrant, it's a $100 fine on a speeding ticket. Why don't you go in and get that taken care of?
Dominguez says in Sheridan County, they also call to alert people that they have outstanding warrants.
The community looks at us in a different way if we're calling them and talking to them about that versus arresting them right away.
Albany County doesn't call. It used to mail out postcards with warrant information, but Undersheriff Josh DeBree says it was a lot of work without great results. As for the mom who was arrested picking up her daughter, she says she didn't know about the warrant. I'm not using her name to protect her daughter's privacy. She says that night in jail only made it harder to pay the outstanding fine because the next morning she missed 2 hours of work.
So, yeah, it cost me some money. It cost me some stress. It cost my daughter some stress. It cost, her going to school the next day and not being 100% because of everything that had happened. It's kind of a snowball and it keeps going.
She admits none of this would have happened had she paid her car insurance. But she says law enforcement also has a choice to help make a situation better or make it worse. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Ten Sleep Canyon has become a popular destination for rock climbers looking for adventure. But some are concerned that parts of their adventure might be manufactured. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reported on a controversy that is starting to bring climbers together.
Ten Sleep Canyon sits on the southwestern edge of the Bighorn National Forest, and it's always been a destination for rock climbers. President of the Bighorn Climbers Coalition, Alex Green, says in the past couple of years, the area's popularity has exploded.
Ten Sleep Canyon has been seeing a pretty big resurgence in the rock climbing development over the last handful of years, and that resurgence has come with its share of pros and cons.
Green says more people have been developing rock climbing routes or paths up a rock in Ten Sleep. He says the rocks in there are limestone and it requires some cleaning before it's safe to climb.
You need to pull off loose flakes, loose rocks. You need to file down like razor sharp edges, make sure they're not going to cut you. Sometimes get rid of a little bit of vegetation if it's growing in the middle of the route. There's kind of like a minimal standard that absolutely needs to happen when you're developing limestone.
That's where climbers have had some differences in the past year. In 2018, climbers in the canyon started noticing that some of the newer climbing routes were looking a little too clean, something they call manufactured.
Instead of just filing down a razor sharp edge so a pocket doesn't cut you when you put your fingers into it, they might make the mouth of the pocket bigger so you can fit three fingers into it instead of two or something like that.
Green says his group started hearing about routes that had drilled holes for pockets, as well as some with rock that had been reinforced with a type of glue. That's led to a big conversation about what is considered ethical route development in the canyon. The man at the center of this controversy is Louis Anderson. Anderson has climbed intensely for more than 20 years and moved to the area about 4 years ago. He's developed around 150 routes since moving here and owns a local business that offers climbers a place to stay when they visit the canyon. Anderson says he met with local climbers and route developers about his behavior in June 2018.
And those conversations I thought went quite well. That initial meeting and then follow-up conversations over the following month or so kind of led me to reevaluate what I was doing and change my opinion on the tactics that I was comfortable using. And I told these people that. And from that point on, I haven't done those things.
Anderson says he spent the last year or so trying to regain the trust of the climbing community. But in February, several longtime Ten Sleep climbers brought more attention to the issue with a published open letter attacking Anderson's practices. Alex Green with the Bighorn Climbers Coalition says the published letter forced his group to react.
It necessitated a very direct response and a more public response, I think, than we were initially preparing for.
So the organization started holding route developer roundtables where climbers could get together and talk about what's been happening in Ten Sleep, which has led to them writing a guidance document for route development.
It's being written by members of the local community. We're getting input from everybody on all sides of this, and we're going to be coming up with a set of guidelines and standards that I think we can all be happy with moving forward.
But while it looked like the issues were being resolved, a group of people went to the canyon in the middle of the night and took down some of the routes Anderson had developed. Green says about 70 routes in the canyon were negatively affected.
30-ish were totally stripped and removed from the wall. They just don't exist anymore as routes. Another 30-ish were kind of partially affected. They put red padlocks on the first bolt of a lot of routes. A handful of routes, they filled in some holds that they thought were manufactured with epoxy or broke some holds off the wall even.
The actions prompted the U.S. Forest Service to finally get involved. Powder River District Ranger Tracy Weaver says they will now be enforcing rules on route development in the canyon.
You can't go and manufacture, you can't create trails or routes or anything on national forests without a permit or a operating plan.
Weaver says they made the decision to put a pause on route development to give everyone a chance to cool down from the tension over the past year.
Basically, what it was, from my perspective, was to get everybody to take a tactical pause, to move forward more thoughtfully and on the same page.
The Forest Service has hired a ranger to solely focus on climbing. He'll be working in Ten Sleep to educate climbers on sustainable practices and taking an inventory of climbing routes and the impacts of climbing. Weaver says they'll also be working with climbers to finish up a climbing management plan for the forest.
We'll definitely work with them on the, you know, the route development ethics that they're working on right now. We'll make sure that there's information in there about the wilderness area and how we want to manage that. And then as well as, you know, addressing dispersed camping and human waste and dogs and, you know, all of the other impacts that people potentially have when they come to climb here.
The Forest Service granted the Bighorn Climbers Coalition $22,000 to start surveying the canyon as the first steps to getting the management plan. Last year, the coalition mapped trails and dispersed camping in the canyon. Currently, they've been working on an archaeological survey. There is no definite timeline on when a final management plan would be ready. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Ten Sleep.
For a lot of people, when they hear about forensic science that's used to solve crime, they think of the CSI television franchise that's set in places like Miami, New York, and Las Vegas. But in fact, one of the most advanced forensic laboratories in the country is here in Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen takes us there.
For a lot of people, when they hear about forensic science, they may think about this. The CSI television franchise is set in places like Miami, New York, and Las Vegas. But in fact, one of the most advanced forensic laboratories in the country is right here in the Mountain West.
We do the wildlife attack cases, and then we do...
That's Kim Frazier, the director of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department's forensic lab. And that buzzing you can sort of hear, that's because Frazier and I are standing in front of three heavy-duty walk-in freezers.
We have a lot of evidence that we keep here, so we have a lot of refrigerator space.
That evidence includes blood and hair samples from all kinds of animals, from pronghorn to mountain lion and bighorn sheep to grizzly bear. Last May, a DNA sample from a black bear showed up from Aspen. It was evidence from a wildlife attack on hiker Janet Jansen.
We'd love to hike. That's the thing we love to do.
Jansen's from Pasco in Washington, but she was in Aspen on summer vacation. She and her husband were hiking Hunter's Creek Trail. It's only about a mile from downtown. Jansen says it was early in the morning on a really beautiful day. They'd been following a stream next to the trail for about 10 minutes.
And then all of a sudden a bear came walking down the trail towards us.
Jansen says they knew not to run. Instead, she says they wanted to give the bear a wide berth, so they slowly started backing up. They backed all the way up to the edge of the stream.
Then he started to pass us, just kept going down the path. And then, you know, when he was right by us, he just kind of randomly pushed me over with his head and bit my leg.
Jansen says at that moment she yelled at the bear.
No, go away, really loud.
And it did. Jansen says she was bleeding pretty heavily, so she laid down in order to elevate her leg while her husband soaked her fleece jacket in the stream to use as a cold compress. Eventually, she and her husband made it back to the trailhead and took a taxi to the hospital.
They didn't want to give stitches because it was puncture wounds. The two back teeth had pretty deep puncture wounds.
Instead, they rinsed the wound with saline and gave her an antibiotic IV. But before that, DNA from Jansen's wound was collected. Matt Yamashita is with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife. He says these cases are treated just like law enforcement would with any other crime.
The difference here is that, you know, our suspect is going to be something that we, you know, obviously we're not able to go out and interview the suspect.
Along with collecting a DNA sample, Yamashita says they canvassed the area, interviewing other hikers and residents to help identify the right bear to be euthanized. But it was video of the bear taken by a resident earlier that week that was the linchpin.
In going through and analyzing the video, we were able to confirm that it was a bear that matched the same general size description, behavioral patterns, even the location. You know, it was coming back within a couple hundred yards of the location of the attack.
After they got a hold of the bear and tranquilized it, they were able to match its teeth measurements to the bite marks on Janet Jansen's leg. But Yamashita says ultimately it was the DNA match that allowed his agency to confirm it was the same bear.
This particular incident, this was a great example of being able to utilize some of these extensive forensic tools like DNA testing in order to help us get 100% clarity on what was happening.
Yamashita says the agency was also able to identify the contents of the bear's stomach. Was full of birdseed, which points to a growing problem across Colorado and the region, conflicts between bears and humans.
The primary issue is humans providing, whether intentionally or accidentally, providing some sort of an artificial food source.
The increasing number of human-animal conflicts are keeping Kim Frazier at the Wyoming Game and Fish Department's forensics lab busy. So is working on the Mountain West CSI unit as exciting as the TV versions in Miami and Las Vegas?
Yeah, you know, it can be both. It can be exciting when we get new cases in, or if we try to bring new testing online, that's exciting. Sometimes, though, it can be the same thing over and over again every day. So yeah, it's really not as glamorous as it sounds.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we will visit UW's much-anticipated College of Engineering. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. This year, we started a series we called Belonging. It features the voices of young people from across Wyoming in conversation with each other, exploring what's behind their decisions to stay or leave. In this episode, recent Torrington High School graduates Quentin Meyer and Ryan Walson say they love Wyoming as it is. The childhood friends sat down to reflect on the agriculture and the stories that pull them to stay, while acknowledging the career possibilities that may draw their lives outside of the state that they hold dear.
I wouldn't change a thing about Wyoming. I love it how it is.
Yeah. I love being able to walk outside and you can see for miles, and there's hills, and I mean, there's a lot of sagebrush, but every once in a while you come across some nice trees.
Yeah, one of the things I always also admire is the open hay fields, especially during the summer. Yeah. You see the hay come grow up, and then they lay it down, and it's laid down, and you see it dry, and you're like, oh, they got to bale it soon. Then they bale it, and the hay grows back up. I think that's cool watching that rotation, I guess you could say, of growing crops and the farming agriculture of this county.
Yeah. Have you ever been tempted to leave Wyoming?
Yeah, and, you know, I kind of plan on doing that. Well, it's hard to say. You know, engineering, I'm going to start in Casper because one of my main goals in life is to come out of college completely debt-free. And to do that, I did kind of use livestock judging as a way of paying for my college. So I'll be livestock judging and doing engineering at Casper College. And then after that, I'm going to have to find a university to finish that with, whether that's UW, or I also got an offer from Texas A&M. And finding an engineering job in Wyoming is going to be a lot harder than places like the metropolitan area like Denver. I mean, that'd be a lot easier finding a civil engineering job or a mechanical engineering job because there's so much more infrastructure and so much more building that's going on there. That's really what comes down for me. I would love to live in Wyoming when I'm older. I mean, that's my kind of my goal, is to retire here and have a ranch with some sheep or cattle or something. Have you been tempted to leave?
I have been a little bit because I'm going to school in Milford, Nebraska to become a John Deere tech. And I mean, around here, there are a lot of people that need tractors and stuff worked on, but you can leave and go to a bigger place or a bigger community and stuff, and you can find a job for more money, but it also does come down to where do you want to live, where are you happy, and stuff like that. So it's kind of up in the air, but definitely not moving anytime soon.
Has there ever been a time that you felt like you didn't belong in Wyoming?
I honestly don't think so. I mean, been here my whole life, and just everything I do is pretty easy to do in Wyoming.
Yeah.
Going out and shooting raccoons on canal roads.
Yep.
Spotlighting coyotes and stuff like that.
Yep. You can't do that in a big city. You can't go just driving on the canal road shooting raccoons in the middle of the night.
Shoot a raccoon in town in New York,
you're getting sent
to jail. You're 5 feet from somebody else.
Yep, yeah. I got to agree with you. I don't know if there's been a time I've ever not felt like I belonged in Wyoming. It's a pretty welcoming place, I think.
It is.
And that might be because we're born here and we know everybody, but at the same time, I feel like these are great people that are very welcoming. I can't tell you the amount of times I've gone to a family branding or whatever when we go help someone brand, and that's cool, that sense of community, you know. I feel connected to that, connected to ag, connected to farming. I mean, we're not huge into it, but it's still a part of my blood, part of my family.
Yeah, going and working for Dietzler Farms, going out on the ranch and you're just fixing fence and looking, then all you see is hills and grass for miles.
Yes.
And just peaceful, and definitely clears the mind.
Yeah, and you're lonely. It's only you and like your thoughts, and there's nobody else around you except for the cattle, and you can talk to them if you want. I mean, I've done that a few times.
They ain't gonna make fun of you.
Yeah, they ain't gonna make fun of you. They're not gonna judge you. It's kind of a sense of you just being here by yourself. We have that freedom, because who's gonna tell you no in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah. Yeah, Wyoming is definitely type of place that, yep. I mean, you can live a ways away and still have your peace and quiet and feel alone, but with somebody, and you can still drive a little ways and still be able to go find the people and do the things you want in town.
I think it's the balance between the two.
Yeah.
When you feel like you need to have some alone time and or you need to be with people, when you're out on at the farm and you're by yourself, it makes those moments like with people in town even like sweeter, you know?
Yeah.
You got to love that kind of way of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love just being a country folk. One of my most favorite things is the stories of old men and women too. Yeah. I mean, old ranch women are some of the smartest people I know.
Yeah.
Since we just graduated and we know a lot of our classmates are not going to be sticking around here, why do you think that is?
Yes, Torrington is kind of a ranch and farm community, but there are a lot of kids that are kind of wanting to move on to different things, and they're not like they're just not farm and ranch type kids. And just like me, even like you wanting to be a mechanical engineer, there's not really much place you can do that around here.
No, yeah.
So I feel like just for them, they find out what they want to do, kind of can't really stick around here.
Yep.
Yeah, Wyoming is definitely a place more for hunting outfits and ranches.
Yep.
And finally, the University of Wyoming has opened its new engineering education and research facility. The $105 million project is being touted as one of the most advanced learning facilities in the nation and will not only benefit students, but the state and community as well. I had a chance to stop by at the start of the semester. This is the Drilling and Completion Simulator, which is a state-of-the-art hands-on lab where students can learn just about everything they need to know about onshore and offshore drilling. The room is overseen by Tawfiq El Shahabi. He is of the Department of Petroleum Engineering, who tells me to put on some virtual reality goggles.
We have a virtual reality, a drilling rig virtual reality tour. And many of our students maybe never made it to a drilling rig or to the oil field. We take them to a virtual tour.
And there I am, somewhere in Wyoming, looking down from the top of a drilling rig, triggering my fear of heights.
Wow.
Everything you see makes you believe you're in an oil field, and way down below there's equipment, trucks, and it's all scaled to actual size. When you turn or look up and down, it's like you're actually at the rig site. Across the room, he's got another state-of-the-art simulator, and that is one of only two in the world that gives students a hands-on lesson in drilling operations. El Shahabi says the simulator has completely changed how he teaches. He says they can actually do everything someone can in the field in a laboratory setting.
Split them into teams, and every team will be trying to drill it fast and efficient. Then as an instructor, I'll be evaluating the results and giving them an immediate feedback. Same thing with the wireline and all the other simulators.
Before you had this simulator, how would you teach that?
Just showing them some pictures and lecturing, which active learning is more efficient than passive learning.
They also have an offshore rig that teaches students how to operate drilling operations at sea. That is also a state-of-the-art simulator. El Shahabi says UW has always had a good petroleum engineering program, but now it's beyond that.
This simulator here will put the university at the top when it comes to oil and gas industry, because this is the only simulator that look like this in any other school.
And he says when you consider how affordable UW is, this could really grow their program. Engineering Dean Michael Pishko says that was certainly the goal when upgrading the engineering building was first considered about a decade ago. He says lawmakers, Governor Dave Friedenthal, wanted to take the program to the next level and help improve the ability to perform important research, education, and workforce training. And it's not just about oil and gas. Pishko says the new facility allows for active learning or hands-on approaches to teaching and learning, and it has other features.
We have a very large student innovation center, which is a makerspace. And so this is a place where students can design and fabricate what they're thinking of. So that could be anything from parts for an electric Formula One car that we have students working on to projects to help out high school and middle school students.
Makerspace coordinator Tyler Kerr says his facility is like an ultra-cool shop class.
A tinkering discovery area where we teach people how to use a lot of emerging technology that they might not have access to at home.
The highlight is 3D scanners and printers that allow people to print out actual hands-on projects. For instance, you could scan a skull from a faraway place and then print the actual skull out to be used in a classroom. They'll be offering how-to classes for students and the community. Another program is where the Department of Visual Arts on campus and computer science combined to develop a Center for Design Thinking. The goal, according to co-director Brandon Gellis, is to teach people how to bring engineering and design thinking concepts together.
An app is a perfect example on a phone of something that you need a computer scientist and a programmer to develop, but you also need something that looks really interesting and evocative and is intuitive.
The program is hoping to use students to develop entrepreneurial projects that can do a number of things, which include solving some engineering issues in the state. Dean Pishko says these programs and others will certainly change the outlook for UW's engineering and computer science program.
I think it puts us on par with the kinds of facilities that you would see at places like Stanford or MIT.
Pishko says the reaction to the new facility has been fairly uniform. It's been wow. He says potential students have been incredibly impressed, and he expects that to pay dividends in the not-too-distant future. Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. We'll be back next week with a whole new season of shows. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.